You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Before we start, I have a couple of housekeeping notes. The Second City has gone from stage to screen and really everything in between. Our live shows in Chicago will be resuming on May 7th with limited capacity in our main stage theater. Look for our other stages to open up in the coming weeks and months. We're also resuming some live in-person classes, corporate shows, and learning sessions. We continue to have virtual offerings in all these areas, as well as hybrid offerings. You can get all the information you need at secondcity.com.
Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City main stage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I think you're going to enjoy this conversation with Cyril Bouquet. He's a professor at IMD, which is the Institute for Management Development, which is an independent academic institution with Swiss roots and global reach. It was founded 75 years ago by business leaders for business leaders. He is speaking to us from Switzerland, and his book is called Alien Thinking, The Unconventional Path to Breakthrough Ideas. He has two co-authors on the book, Jean-Louis Barceau and Michael Wade. So enjoy my talk with Cyril Bouquet.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Cyril Bouquet, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things that I absolutely loved about this book is the acknowledgement that there's like no six clear steps to innovation, or that the pathway to innovation is a linear process in any way. And I feel a kinship with our work in improvisation, which is about maintaining a certain kind of mindset and a set of practices while you experiment and navigate over time. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you know, I think this is one of my observations also working with executives at IMD, the business school where I work, where I felt that sometimes, you know, they have so much guidance in the field of innovation to approach creativity that it has almost become like a sort of series of templates and checklists. And that was just not my experience of how great ideas emerge in organizations or in various walks of life as well, right? We just can't reduce it to a very scripted process. So yeah, there needs to be some sort of framework. There needs to be some sort of rules that are in existence, if you will, but we have to preserve this sense of freedom and you know, that is so key to creativity. And so I guess, yeah, there's a lot of parallels that you could make with improvisation and the way you think about, you know, how do you create a wonderful play, right, that will captivate an audience and that will be perceived as fundamentally new.
Because the context changes. It always does. And you don't know where it can be outside. It could be inside. It can be environmental. I mean, we're living in this pandemic right now and everyone's had to pivot. So the value here is it's not prescriptive and it's not, you take into account the emotional factor, the psychological way that human beings conduct themselves on a day-to-day basis, because that gets in the way too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I realize that often innovators are victims of their own success, right? I mean, they go through all kinds of emotions through a journey of creation. And the same qualities, if you will, that are so key to explain their creativity and their ability to imagine a world that doesn't exist today. You know, if you're not careful, the same qualities, if you will, can derail them, right? So it's always trying to find, the balance. I need to be persistent, right? I mean, I need to believe in the power of my ideas, but that, persistence, if you're not careful, can also become a level of stubbornness that really, sort of make people stop to listen, right? To other people, to members of their teams or to key stakeholders in the organization, in the industry that have really useful feedback to bring, but somehow we fail to build bridges with them, right? We fail to listen to them. And therefore, this persistence that we have that is required, right? That can turn into a dialogue that stops to exist, a dialogue with myself, essentially, as a lone innovator.
So you talk a lot in the book about divergent thinking. And in the introduction to your book, you start, and the book is filled with this. So you have all the academic insights, but then you have these rich stories from real life. And I would love you to sort of briefly tell us the story that opens the introduction, which is about the ebook and the fact that Sony seemed like the absolute clear leader to disrupt this industry, but they didn't end up disrupting it. They got disrupted.
Yeah, because I guess, they came up with a beautiful device, right? I mean, it had the most wonderful technology. In fact, they really invented a device that helped people to read in a very comfortable way, right? And almost recreated the impression that you had a real physical book in your hands. And yet, that device never took off. Because they never really paid attention to the key issues that publishers, right, faced in their own world. Right? I mean, they wanted to make sure that the IP would be protected. They wanted to make sure also that indeed their profitable their profitability would be maintained. And essentially, Sony never really paid attention to those issues. So they were focused on the user experience, but still, users, the readers, had to download. Right, the book from the Sony web store, and then essentially the publishers were afraid what's going to happen with this. And so when Amazon came in, they essentially focused less on the technology of the device per se, but they felt about how can we remove that pain for consumers, which is I don't want to download anything, I want to be able to have the book in my car just before I'm about to board a plane, and then how can I make sure that publishers, right, are not going to be preoccupied by this IP issue and by the fact that I'm going to lose sales, right, of physical copies. So in fact they use the device to finance or subsidize the publishers to make sure that they would have an incentive, right, to put their books on the Amazon sort of website. And you lose money so that you can create, right, an incentive for publishers to work with you. And that's simply not an imperative for Sony that they believe they had to face at the time. Right? They didn't have to work with publishers to motivate them to put their books on their platform. And Amazon basically realized that it's not just the people who read the books, it's also the publishers. We have those two customers and we have to build a solution that would be very appealing in their eyes. So in the book, we say, Amazon or Sony rather developed an elegant device and Amazon developed a beautiful solution.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and Bezos said, this isn't a device, it's a service. And I've been thinking about that line, even in my own world at Second City and being like, oh, I wonder if we, we need to think of ourselves in the sort of service manner and that might allow us to open doors to many different worlds. And so I think before we jump in, and I do want to cover each of the areas in alien thinking, but let me give the floor to you to sort of talk about this acronym and what each area means, and then we'll jump into the specific areas.
Yeah, sure. So I mean, the book that we wrote really wanted to first recognize that if you want to give yourself a chance to come up with new ideas, you have to be able to get rid of all those experiences and assumptions that you had, on how the world works, which would somehow guides but also limit, right, the way you think about range of possibilities that exist. So you have to think like an outsider, like a beginner, like an alien who would come from a different planet and see things anew. But then obviously, right, it's not enough to have this metaphor, because then we end up in a world where we just tell people, you've got to think outside the box, you've got to think differently, you've got to be a maverick. But, you know, how do we do that in practice? And this is where the book is offering a series of habits or strategies that people, not just in business, but any walk of life, can actually try to implement to give themselves a chance, right? To free themselves up from the logic that dominates everybody else's thinking, right? And so this is the acronym. ALIEN, you know, stands for attention, levitation, imagination, experimentation, navigation. And indeed, there's, you know, very simple way to look at those five habits and think about, you know, how can I use them differently in my life, in my job, you know, to see the world in a new way.
Yeah, and while they go in order, so you have a nice acronym as we referred to earlier, they rarely do go in the same order for everyone based on whatever part of the project. And the other thing I love about this book is like, it is so the opposite of overnight success. I mean, like every one of these stories is like, how long did this take for people to come around? And I think in the attention chapter, or chapter two, you introduce us to this character, and his first name I think is Narayani. I have a hard time with that last name.
Narayana Pisapati, an Indian. Absolutely.
So talk to us about his story, because that is deep attention, and I think that's why you started the book there.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I mean, you know, it's like a sociologist, if you will. You're looking at the world and thinking, you know, geez, there are a number of issues that exist that we can't really explain and that could be solved. And one of the issues that triggered his attention really was that he noticed that the level of water in the ground, if you will, was quickly diminishing in ways that we could not explain, because somehow, you know, year after year you had enough rain in India that would not explain why, you know, the level of water that you could find in the ground was you know, reaching very, very low and dangerous levels. And then he realized, well, you know, it's interesting. You know, people have really started to cultivate rice, right? To much greater extent in recent years. And indeed, rice is extremely consuming of water. And then he realized, well, why is that? And it's because essentially the Indian government was subsidizing farmers so that they could do that. And the way to allow them to cultivate rice was to essentially reduce the cost of electricity use to very negligible levels, and that's what I was explaining. You know, this diminishing of water in the grounds, and the worst is that it didn't really help the economic situation. That rice, you know, was overproduced and so had to be destroyed. It was rotting in warehouses. You know, it was basically there for rats to eat. And so he felt, you know, there must be a better way. And this is when he realized, well, you know, there is something else. There is millet that we could use that is much better for the environment, that doesn't consume as much water. And somehow we could turn that into a lot of meals, right? And then he basically decided that to start, rather than to convince people to eat millet instead of rice, he designed a company that created this edible cutlery. So indeed, you know, people would use the spoons and forks and knives that would be made of millet, and then at the end of the meal they would simply eat, you know, their cutlery. And of course, this created a lot of interesting buzz on social media, and then indeed he was able to convince all kinds of other food manufacturers to start, you know, producing meals that would use millet rather than rice. And that is, you know, again, how do you pay attention to a number of interesting facts about, you know, farming practices and government incentives and habit consumptions, to be able to sort of put those together and then come up with a new way of organizing economic activity that would make sense for the users, but also contribute to the planet, right? That needs to be able to produce behaviors that are sustainable in the long term.
And this took like over a decade. I mean, like he had this just novel solution, and then like a camera crew shows up one day, and suddenly it turns viral, and then so I mean, it's like it's amazing how much is out of your control.
Yeah.
Right. And then the book is so focused too on the personal resilience of these individuals to kind of take the time when they knew they had the great concept or idea, and it basically needed to find its time to emerge with factors that were often out of their control.
That's right. And it's amazing, when I see the work we do with organizations and the pressure that is put on executives to produce. Yeah. Right now.
Yeah.
And so even when you give them an innovation mandate, typically the companies give them 6 months, right? 6 months to essentially prove the merit of their ideas. And after 6 months, we expect those ideas, once we've proven their merit, to be sort of cycled through the next phase of implementation. And then organizations are surprised that they don't end up with a lot of breakthrough thinking and radical innovation. Well, because essentially they conceptualize innovation as a series of sprints, right? Prototyping sprints. When in fact we know that true innovation, radical thinking requires, right, very long time frames, and it's more of a marathon and not a series of sprints, right? And so one of the stories that we talk in the book as well is our famous, Bertrand Piccard, who is well known for having flown, the solar impulse plane throughout the world, without any source of energy, but the solar, the solar energy, if you will. And it took him 13 years to essentially, sort of continue to experiment, using a computer with digital twins of versions of his plane, right? The concept that would help him to actually go around the world. And so often, right, those major innovations take a long time. It took 23 years to Nespresso to be able to find out, the business model that could explain, right, the success of that concept. But often people sort of look at the result and they're like, oh, yeah, that must be an act of genius. But actually, there's a lot of experimentation going on over periods of years. There's often a little bit of serendipity, right? If you look at the innovation, the way it exists at the end, is very seldom connected to the original insights that people had when they started the journey. So there was a lot of learning along the way. There were a few discoveries. And there were a few twists and turns that could never have been conceptualized as such when the journey started. So you had to be open, right, to learning throughout, right? And you had to be patient enough to see how your initial insights could evolve and turn into something that was magnificent that you would have never imagined at the start.
And too, that attention isn't one thing. You say that to see better, you can either zoom in or zoom out. And I thought the Kellogg story was wonderful, where they were looking for new insights on healthier snacks for school children. They talked to kids, they talked to parents, classic focus group. But the novel solution didn't come from those folks, did they?
It came from, indeed, I mean, they talked to all of those, usual suspects, if you will, right? And then they realize, well, we are not getting any insight. I mean, we've talked to the nutritionists, we've talked to the teachers, the parents, the kids themselves, but we're trying to develop a healthier diet for the kids, and we're not coming up with any novel insight. And then they talk to the school janitors, right? So they switch focus. They actually said, who else haven't we talked to? And then they realized that actually the janitors had access to critical information that nobody had access to. Right, because the school janitors were there, when the kids were playing during recess. They were also there, at the odd hours of the night. And so, in fact, they could see things like in school recess, what is being traded, on the black market, if you will, right? I mean, people are just exchanging items. They are throwing things in the garbage. Or in fact, they found, garbage bins that were full of apples. So not just, it's not because you take something out of the cafeteria that you're actually going to eat it. And so it's when they started to talk to the school janitors that they realized, well, maybe there's all kinds of things that are happening that are under the radar that we didn't have, any understanding of. And so that's what Asian thinkers do, right? I mean, they understand the value of connecting with people at the fringe, people, that maybe you think are a little bit odd or will not bring you the key insights. But actually, by having those kinds of real conversations, right, you may be focusing on elements, right, that have just been ignored, right, by the expert in the field who didn't see those conversations as being relevant, right, essentially to their creation process. But, you know, some companies have institutionalized that. I mean, in the same chapter, we talked about IKEA and we talked about Lego, you know, that are trying to understand, you know, how is it that people use our products, right, in ways that we had never anticipated before. And when we pay attention to those anomalies, right, we often understand, well, you know, in fact, you know, there's something there, right, that could be giving us a new type of energy, right, that could be put to use when it comes to imagining the future products, the future services that we could create for the world.
Yeah, we talk at Second City about operating leadership at every level and recognize empowering people. And this isn't a novel idea. Peter Drucker was talking about this ages ago, but it's still, it hasn't hooked in. The hierarchies are all still there. So I think as organizations, you have to work pretty hard, and it's important to make sure you're hearing those different voices. And I wonder, as we shift to sort of levitation, So I think everyone understands, attention I think most people get, but this word levitation is very specific and not used often, I think, in business books. So tell us what you mean by levitation.
Yeah, and in fact, it's interesting you mentioned that, because, you know, before the book, we published an article for Harvard Business Review, and you know, it was still the alien framework, and they renamed levitation as perspective, because I guess they felt it was too exotic, right? But in fact, for us, levitation really represents, right, the important task of really, you know, again, gaining perspective, elevating yourself, right? And in fact, separating yourself from what it is that you're doing. And again, it goes back to this notion of innovation that is not a sprint, right? I mean, often we are rushing to the next task, and you know, we have to be able to make sense of what we're doing to avoid being on this sort of narrow path that we see is happening often, right? People have an idea about what is the problem they're trying to solve. They relatively quickly come up with a solution, and then they just want to prove that they're right. They want to implement that solution as quickly as possible, but they fail to really make sense of what they're doing and potentially improving the value of their creativity process, you know, through. And you know, we know from neuroscience that indeed we need to give ourselves a chance, right, to pause and reflect. When we really look at, you know, what is explaining, right, the process, right, of how the brain works that can create new ideas, we realize that you know, these processes, if you will, don't occur unless you stop doing what you're doing and take the time to reflect. And it's quite interesting. In the 70s, 80s, you know, they started to experiment with brain imaging technologies, and they put, you know, sort of like, you know, they ran experiments that were quite interesting. They asked people, okay, you know, you're going to be working on a very complex cognitive task. Maybe we'll ask you to resolve a math, you know, puzzle, or we'll ask you to write a poem, and we'll measure the parts of your brain that are lining up. And then they took another group of people and they say, you know, you're just going to take a little bit of a break, right? You might take a walk in the forest. You might just sleep and take a nap. And then they compare the two scans, right? The two brain scans. And it's quite interesting what they found. And for many years, neuropsychologists, you know, could not really explain that puzzle. So first, you know, they found that it was slightly different parts of your brain that would light up. But then they also found that the brain of people who were supposedly at rest was 20 times more consuming of energy than the brain of people who were actually processing, right, a very complex task. And how do you explain that? And they realized that, in fact, the brain of the people who are supposedly at rest is firing like crazy, right? And is doing three things, right? The parts of your brain that are lighting up, if you will, are the parts of your brain that are involved with introspection, right? Taking the time to reflect on what is it that you're doing? Is it working or is it not working? Do you need to change your approach, right? Introspection. But then also consolidating everything that you've learned, right? Everything that you've seen, that you've heard, and storing that into your part of the brain that is called the hippocampus, And essentially then projecting your views on the future. And for neuroscientists, your views on the future are nothing else than a reinterpretation of what you've seen in the past. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting. And there's, I was just reading again about the work of a neuroscientist. Her name is Eleanor Maguire. And, you know, she found, for example, that people who had amnesia are not able to think about the future. Patients who have amnesia are not able to imagine the future. Mm-hmm. And that really shows, you know, that we need to be able to take the time to pause, to reflect, to let our brains, you know, or to give the space to our brains to imagine the future in different ways. Right. And so you have people like Kevin Cashman, who wrote an interesting book, The Pause Principle. He asks, where do you come up with your best ideas? And people say in my shower, yeah. Commuting to work or at the gym, when their brain supposedly is doing nothing.
And it's interesting. I hadn't thought of this connection to that, but I feel like that's when the Zen Buddhists talk about like right sweeping. I feel like this is what they're talking about. Like if you just focus on the act that you're doing in a sort of pure way and not try to let all these other things out there, you are going to help your mind process these ideas.
That's right. Like look into the own recesses of your mind, essentially, right? Disconnect from all the pressures, all the stimuli, right, that are around you, and give yourself a chance to think, right? I mean, we talked about Bertrand Piccard, and, you know, how did the idea of solar impulse, you know, was born? It was not because he was paying attention to you know, environmental factors and realizing that the world needs, you know, cleaner sources of energy. But it was because he had just landed, you know, from his trip around the world in a balloon, and he was stranded in the desert, you know, for 6 hours waiting for you know, helicopters to pick him up. And he was thinking about his next challenge. And he had realized that for his entire trip trying to fly a balloon around the world, he was worried about, you know, saving fuel. Mm-hmm. And then waiting for 6 hours, he realized, well, maybe the answer is not, you know, to save fuel, it's to get rid of fuel entirely. Mm-hmm. And that was his next challenge. But he needed 6 hours in the desert, stranded with nothing else to do, to essentially let your mind reconceptualize the problem that he was trying to solve and come up with a different solution.
Yeah, there's a number of stories in the book of trying to give employees their 6 hours in the desert, and whether it's sending executives to like Silicon Valley. And I've talked before about we traded with IDEO. They came to our place for a month. We came to their place for a month. And all that stuff inspired both parties. I want to talk about imagination, because one of the things when we talk about Second City taking its improvisational practices into the corporate world, we are essentially playing games with these executives. However, when we've talked about play or playing games, that does not sell well. Like the bosses don't want them playing games, but they really like them improvising. So it's interesting, because you also say in the book, quote, play has long been recognized as integral to imagination. But education, work, it feels like imagination is just like drummed out of us as we get older.
Yeah, you know, it's true. It's completely true. And you know, it's fascinating to see that kids are imaginative, right? I mean, they don't censor, right, ideas. They are willing to experiment and see what happens. That's how they learn. But indeed, you know, like as we go older, we don't want to play, right? Because we feel that somehow, you know, the world is watching us. So we like to have a clear idea as to what it is that we want to do at the start of an innovation journey, right? Indeed, we have to be able to talk in very sophisticated ways about the problem that we're trying to solve. We have to imagine solutions that are truly radical and then be able to sell them, right, to key stakeholders around us, right? And we stop playing because we're afraid of failing. We're afraid of what people would think about the value of what we're doing. And you know, indeed, in the book, we try to advance the view that imagination is all about playing. You don't know what you're going to create at the start, right? You just got to try, and you've got to put things together a little bit like when kids, you know, again, put Lego bricks together. And in fact, I often ask people, right, in my class, I said, you've got 30 seconds. I give them six Lego bricks, and I say, you've got 30 seconds to actually create a duck. And in 30 seconds, they all come up with different ducks. And it's amazing, right? And then say, look, you're very creative. But, you know, they didn't have time to think, right? So they all imagined different combinations, different representations of what a duck could look like. And some are quite innovative, right? Mm-hmm. But they never thought, because I said you only have 30 seconds, right? So they just started to play. They just started to put things together. And then they realized, well, you know, I would have never intellectualized this, right? I would have never imagined this particular version of the duck. And if you look at science, and if you look at artistry, and you look at you know, the achievements of people across sectors of life, you often see that the truly creative ideas are just the result of, you know, people doing things without really understanding at first what the hell they were doing, but then ending up realizing, yeah, this is kind of interesting. Let me follow this route, right? And you know, that's why you've got to play. But school doesn't help, you know, like when the moment we get into school, we are concerned about performance, we won't succeed, we know we're going to be judged by others. And so we stop doing that, right? Mm-hmm. We stop playing. And that's a big problem for imagination.
Well, yeah. And I think it's the reason that for many people, they you know, they put on plays and they participate in sports and all these other things because they recognize they're going to get value out of those collective experiences in terms of making stuff up with other people that really are truly important to the educational process. And again, you know, we keep seeing what do they cut when they're, you know, need to cut down costs in education. It's like, well, we'll get rid of a sport or we'll get rid of a art, you know, yes. And it's like, well, okay, you're not helping things. In the chapter on experimentation, I have a brother who's an architect, but I don't know much about it because I would never thought of Frank Gehry as someone who experimented. That felt to me from a distance because those buildings are crazy and they're you know, incredible design, but you talk about his process and that was an amazing insight into how he approaches his architectural design with massive experimentation.
Yeah, and you know, that's often, again, what happens, right? When we see wonderful creations and we think about the artists who are involved in those creations, there's always this romantic idea, right, that they are different than us, right? I mean, they think differently, they have those grand visions, and somehow they have they are the creative type that maybe a lot of us, you know, don't share, right? But in fact, you know, when you look again at all those creators, right, they do believe in experimentation, and Frank Gehry is no different, right? Except that he has a very interesting and extreme way of practicing experimentation. And that's often true of good architects, right? And they come, they tell you, listen, like, this is the kitchen, you know, that we could design for you. And then, you know, what is it that you like and what is it that you don't like? And you give feedback. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this was a weird kitchen. You're like, you know, why are they showing us, you know, this kitchen? And then obviously they come back and you expect that it's going to be an improved version of that same kitchen. But it's something completely different. Mm-hmm. And that's what Frank Gehry would do, not for kitchen, but for, you know, different versions of the Guggenheim Museum or the Louis Vuitton Foundation in Paris. He would show his patients, or his clients, rather. You could almost treat them as patients because he's taking care of them, right, in very interesting ways. He would show his clients what he would call Shrek prototypes. And Shrek is a Yiddish expression to say making people nervous, right? He wanted to elicit strong emotional reactions from his clients. So he would show them prototypes that he would never dare to actually implement, very extreme views of you know, what you could realize, and he would get feedback. And then he would show another extreme view and he would get feedback. And then a third extreme view. But in each iteration, he would actually learn something about, you know, what is it that we could create together, right? It's a true process of co-creation. And you don't simply come with a version of what you intend to do and then get feedback and iterate and improve on that, right? You go and you have multiple versions of reality, but the purpose is to get strong reactions so that you can really, you know, construct together something that is going to be really creative.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we know in our work at Second City, which is, you know, the greatest ideas, the greatest scenes often start at the wildest places, you know, yes. They're sort of like, all right, this thing will never work. And then let's try it. And lo and behold, it turns into something kind of amazing. And that's because we humans limit ourselves and back to even play, you know, I just think about our work with the behavioral economists, which is people's default position is to do nothing or say no, you know? So first of all, that's, you're battling that. And then you're battling all the other sort of elements. And so I think it's not enough just to tell someone this is how you get creative. They have to build up that muscle over time. I'm sure Gary doing that the first few times was scary because it's like, well, you know, they're going to be like, you're crazy. I'm never going to hire you. But, you know, if you have real vision, you're going to trust your crazy ideas will lead to novel successes.
That's right. I mean, you've got to trust your crazy ideas, and you've got to give yourself the chance, right, to explore long enough, right? And again, that's the problem in organizations. I mean, often I've worked, you know, with teams where the CEO is kind of watching over the shoulder of the teams, and immediately, right, after one day, 1 week, or 1 month, you know, trying to refocus the conversation on feasibility. Can we do this, right? I mean, can we do this? And the moment you bring this, and if it's not feasibility, it's viability. You know, how can we make money with this?
Yeah.
And the sooner you bring those considerations, the more you're going to reorient the thinking towards very incremental ideas that can actually be implemented.
Right.
You know, where you can see the potential revenue streams, but you're going to kill all of the more distant, right, concepts, you know, that are maybe a little bit more exciting, but that will take more time to be able to work out, right? Your reasoning around those important issues. And so you've got to give yourself a chance, right, to explore. And I guess Frank Gehry maybe doesn't have, right, investors looking over his shoulder. He doesn't have a buzz that is, you know, requiring immediate results. And he can work with slightly longer time frame, right? Than most leaders in organizations can afford.
Okay, the navigation chapter was my favorite chapter, I've got to say. And it's the most complex in some ways. And I love that you start with this Swiss explorer, Sarah Marquis. Seems like a fascinating figure. And the, you know, what she does before she treks to these places is massively prepare, massively study the terrain. And one of the things, this is a great quote in the book, was, you know, she wants to know how people died in these spaces. And that makes sense because she says, quote, "I want to know how people died there so that I don't die." Which makes perfect sense. But it's, I don't think people, we get this all the time. We're like, well, you're just making it up. It's like, yeah, there's a lot of work that went into before we started just making it up.
Yeah. And, you know, and I want to know if I run out of food, you know, where am I going to get to get, you know, alternative sources of food? And so that means that you've got to study, because she got sick, right? I mean, she ran into those situations where, you know, the trip took much longer than expected. She was alone in the middle of a jungle or a desert. And then all of a sudden, you've got to improvise, right? I mean, you've got to be able to find new sources of food, and you better have done your homework. Otherwise, you're going to eat different types of foods and that might be potentially dangerous for your health, and it happened to her. You know, if you need to be able to communicate with the local tribes, you need to be able to know, you know, how can I communicate with them? So she would even, again, invest months studying some basic, right, like language skills to be able to communicate with local tribes, you know, if ever she needed to get help along the way. And again, most people think about themselves and they, you know, but they don't often underestimate the amount of preparation that is required to map all the forces that could either support your project or, you know, sort of slow you down, or even worse, you know, sort of kill you along the way. And because innovators and creative people in general, you know, are really excited about their ideas. They are really excited about, you know, what makes them special, but they are less excited about, hey, all the people who will not get it, all the people who will stand in front of them because somehow they have, you know, things that they want to protect, right? And how do you engage those people? Because if you're not careful, right, your idea might be beautiful, but they might they might do things that will kill, you know, your efforts along the way. So how do you prepare for that? How do you engage them? And again, we don't talk a lot about that in traditional innovation circles. You know, we talk about creativity, and then implementation is something well that other people will figure out. But in fact, no, implementation starts from the very beginning. How you engage people around you, how do you navigate those forces, will explain your success at the end of the day. And you've got to be very prepared for that.
Well, those are two, so often competing worlds. I mean, this is the interesting thing about alien thinking that you talked about, which is it's about understanding people. And then it's also about understanding systems. And those a lot of people don't, and I think I'm one of them. Like I'm good with the people. I am less, I've been less successful with understanding systems. But true innovators have to have, you know, both those things in their mind. Those two qualities are not, I think, often found in most human beings, which is probably why these innovators are special in some ways.
Yeah, I guess, you know, what is interesting when you try to bring a creative idea to a team, to an organization, to an industry, is that, you know, this creative idea is going to have a lot of impact for different actors that are trying to preserve a certain organization, a certain system. And you need to be able, you know, how is it that my idea is disrupting the existing way of doing things? Because those actors are trying to protect, they have interest in place, they have egos, and it's never quite clear initially, right, when they come up with a new idea, is it going to make the system better off, or is it going to disrupt it in a way that is not actually perceived to be good, you know, by the actors within that system. And often innovators underestimate, right, the complexity that they will face, or the skepticism and the opposition even that they will face when they start to change the characteristics of that system. So there's a great example in a book about Steve Sasson, right? If you remember, Steve Sasson was actually the inventor of the first digital camera. But interestingly, he worked for Kodak, right? And so Kodak was killed by the technology that one of their engineers invented. But why is that? When he invented the first digital camera, he took a picture and essentially showed, you know, the top executives of the company at the time, ladies and gentlemen, this is filmless photography. And he was part of it. This is filmless photography. But obviously, when he did this, he, you know, created a lot of uncertainty and a lot of skepticism from people who believe that what made this company special was precisely their capacity to create wonderful films, right? So his invention clashed with all the certainty that people had around what made this company unique, different, and successful over the years. And it took him a few years to evolve the language from having designed a filmless technology to digital film. And when he started to talk about digital film, obviously he created a lot more support, right, within the organization, but it was a little bit too late. In the process, they had wasted, you know, precious time developing further this technology, and now they were late. And so innovators really need to understand, you know, what are the frictions, a little bit like Sarah Marquis, right? When I come up with this innovative idea, you know, what am I going to disrupt, right? Who am I going to disrupt? And is there a way that I can build bridges, right? So it's not just about breaking the system because I have a better way of organizing it. It's about, you know, how can I build bridges with actors in that system so that they can see the merit of what it is that I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, Netflix is a great example of that, right? You know, they thought they were in one business and they ended up being in another business. And had they stayed in their old business, they would be Blockbuster.
They would be Blockbuster, but indeed, you know, when you approach, you know, key actors, I think they initially approach Blockbuster, right? And they said, you know, hey, we have a new way of organizing your activities, and Blockbuster said, no, this takes us into a totally different territory that doesn't look very good to us, right? Because it requires a completely different mindset, a completely different set of capabilities which they didn't have, so they were trying to protect that system. But, you know, the way you frame things, right, could either, you know, elicit support or could create very strong opposition. And the CEO of French La Poste, with whom I've worked, right, was telling me, you know, all organizations want to change. but you've got to change so that you can stay the same. And I think, you know, when I disrupt the system, you know, can I create enough excitement, right, you know, among actors that are within that system so that they want to work with me rather than see my idea as some sort of virus that needs to be killed, right? Because that's what happens. Organizations have designed corporate immune systems, right? When they see a new idea, they're not quite sure what it's going to do for them in the future. So treat it like a virus, right? Like kill it so that you have more time to think about it.
I've had the very weird experience of talking to three different people who were in that meeting between Blockbuster and Netflix. Yeah. And all three have very different stories about what happened and how it happened and what was being proposed. And I think that's part of the problem, right? And which is why in the book you talk about how important having a great story to go along with your innovation is key. And I don't think anyone there really knew what story they were telling.
No, and I think, again, he was a great engineer, Steve Sassen.
Yep.
But, you know, maybe it's a little bit like the Sony device that we were talking about. You know, what are you emphasizing in your story? Are you talking about, you know, the quality of the picture resolution? the fact that, I mean, what is part of your pitch, right? Are you building bridges? Are you essentially showing that you have a different way of doing something that is extremely important to the people in the room, right? That you're all united, you all have the same goal, the same sense of destiny, if you will. And if we want to get there, you know, then maybe there's a slightly different way of doing things. But often innovators don't do that, right? They emphasize what is important to them. They emphasize the uniqueness of their ideas, but they fail to build those bridges. And then the innovation director of Lego who said, you know, you shouldn't be a rebel. You should be a diplomatic rebel, right? So yeah, you have a different idea, but try to show how it's not that different. Because if you're able to do that, if you're able to build those bridges, you know, then you will be able to get support that will be key to your journey moving forward.
All right. The way we end the podcast every week is we ask our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when two people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. They actually don't get that far by saying yes. We say yes and, so you can explore and heighten a particular idea. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I thought about this, you know, like yesterday night and this morning. And then I felt, you know, of course I have tons of stories in the business world, right? Because we implement yes and principles. I've worked with actors and theater directors, you know, and how do you get a team to listen to each other and really become a very effective team? And I could have told stories around that, but I thought that I would choose a personal story actually, because the power of yes and is not just, you know, that it has applications for the business world. It does. But in fact, it helps us as parents. It helps us, you know, ourselves to reflect on, you know, the situations that we experience every day. And so I remembered an interesting story with my daughter. I have two kids, you know, 12 and 8. But this was a story about my daughter when she was 3. And you know, we live in Switzerland where we are very close to the mountains. And so every weekend and every vacation, we are skiing. And, you know, there was this particular hill that my daughter wanted to go over after a big shoot, right? So she was like going down like crazy. And then there was this little hill that she wanted to go over, but she could never get to the top because she was too light. Mm-hmm. And her brother, you know, smart ass, you know, basically told her, hey, you know, it's because you're standing too much on the back of your skis, you know, stand like this and you'll see, you'll go through. And of course she didn't. And she was disappointed. And she told me, Dad, she was crying, that's it, I have enough, you know, I want to go home. I'm done skiing. And she was free. But that's literally what she was telling. You know, she was fine. And, you know, I've known, you know, you should never stop skiing when you just fail, right? I mean, you should continue. Right. And I just wanted to say, come on, don't be a drama queen. Get back on your skis and let's continue skiing. But I didn't do that. I said, yes, we're going to stop skiing. And of course, you know, just before we do that, we'll stop at the restaurant so that you can have a hot chocolate. Would you like that? And she said, of course, I'd like that. So we stop at the restaurant. And of course, after the hot chocolate, we went back and, you know, she wanted to ski for another 45 minutes, you know, before we went home. And it's interesting, as if I had said, no, stop being a drama queen, get back on your skis, it would have been more drama, right? She would have cried more and felt I didn't understand her, but just say, yes, of course, we'll do that. And before we do that, why don't we have a hot chocolate? It totally changed, you know, the continuation of our journey.
Yeah, well, and then and she had time to reflect. And maybe I want to go try this again. I love it. Yeah. The book is called Alien Thinking, The Unconventional Path to Breakthrough Ideas. Cyril Bouquet, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.